calls are growing for the immediate removal of the U.S. president a day after a deadly rioting on Capitol Hill by his supporters. U.S. President-elect Joe Biden has denounced the storming of the Capitol by Donald Trump supporters as an unprecedented assault on democracy. And Syria has called on the U.N. Security Council to stop Israeli attacks on the Arab country, which it says threaten regional stability. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to World News. Top U.S. Democrats are now calling for the removal of the U.S. president from office a day after pro-Trump's protesters laid siege to the Capitol building.
In calling for this seditious act, the president has committed an unspeakable assault on our nation and our people.
Nancy Pelosi branded Trump a very dangerous person, describing his removal as an emergency of the highest magnitude. Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer said yesterday's events will not have happened without Trump in the White House. Two Democratic leaders have urged Vice President Mike Pence to invoke the 25th Amendment, which can unseat a president if he's deemed unfit for office. Reports show, however, that the Vice President has opposed that idea. Democrats, including House Judiciary Chairman Gerald Nadler, are calling for bringing impeachment charges against the president now as a last resort. U.S. President-elect Joe Biden says Wednesday's insurrection and storming of the Capitol building is an assault on democracy.
Yesterday, in my view, one of the darkest days in the history of our nation. An unprecedented assault on our democracy. An assault, literally, on the citadel of liberty and the United States Capitol itself.
Biden noted the outbreak of violence is a result of President Donald Trump's unrelenting attacks on democracy, stressing American presidents are not above the law. Biden also accused Trump of using a mob to silence voices of American voters. He stated that black protesters would have been treated differently had they stormed the Capitol. U.S. President-elect added that the country's Justice Department has been badly damaged under Trump's leadership. Comments come a day after Trump supporters overran the Congress building
yesterday,
pushed lawmakers to overturn presidential election results.
Outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump has finally declared there will be an orderly transition of power. The news comes after violence in the nation's capital as Trump supporters stormed the Capitol building while lawmakers met to certify President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris. World leaders joined the chorus of outrage condemning the outgoing president for stoking the unrest. For weeks he undermined the result, claiming election fraud, and then rallied protesters to head to the Capitol. As angry demonstrators stormed Congress, one woman was shot dead by police and three others died of, quote, medical emergencies. An improvised explosive device was also intercepted by authorities. As the situation deteriorated, fellow Republicans urged Trump to call his protest off. Hours later, he posted a video reiterating his claims of fraud. He also cheered his supporters, saying he loved them and described them as special, but called on them to remain calm and return home. In an unprecedented step, Twitter took down the video and suspended his account, threatening permanent suspension if he continued to violate the social media platform. President of the European Council, Charles Michel, took to Twitter to voice his concerns. He joined world leaders calling for a peaceful transfer of power. Earlier, UK Home Secretary Priti Patel was asked about Trump's role in stoking anger and mistrust in the electoral process.
We've just seen, confidence in democracy being shattered, quite frankly, and there's no justification for the level of violence, full stop, that was on show and has been on display, and people have been assaulted, people have died. The violence, should stop, and he should absolutely condemn everything that has taken place.
In the early hours, Republican Senator Mitt Romney blamed President Trump for inciting a violent insurrection. He also downplayed suggestions of a congressional audit to placate angry Trump supporters.
For any who remain insistent on an audit in order to satisfy the many people who believe that the election was stolen, I'd offer this perspective. No congressional audit is ever going to convince these voters, particularly when the president will continue to say that the election was stolen.
Many predicted unrest, but Wednesday's scenes went beyond expectation. Four people dead, with lawmakers having to cower and abandon the historic building. In less than 2 weeks, President-elect Joe Biden will be inaugurated in the very same building, but with scenes of unrest, authorities will be bracing for more potential chaos, as the world watches the most powerful nation descend into even greater levels of division.
Now, the UN has urged U.S. President Donald Trump to disavow false and dangerous narratives, as Wednesday's storming of the Capitol shows the destructive impact of incitement, of violence, and hatred. Michelle Bachelet, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, said the attack demonstrates clearly the destructive impact of sustained and deliberate distortion of facts by political leaders. UN Rights Chief also backed calls for a thorough probe into Wednesday's chaos in Washington, D.C. Meanwhile, Amnesty International has slammed Trump's rejection of election results, saying his provocation of supporters has fanned the flames of chaos and violence. Amnesty said that the U.S. president's refusal to facilitate a peaceful transfer of power has put human rights and the rule of law at risk. Violence has also drawn criticism from the Germans.
The scenes at the U.S. Capitol we have seen are the result of lies and more lies, and dividing and a contempt for democracy, of hatred and hate speech, also from the very top. That is a historical turning point for the United States, and it is an attack on the liberal democracy. But I am convinced the U.S. democracy is stronger than this hatred. The democratic institutions are stronger than the hatred.
Steinmeier said that hatred and agitation, lies and violence all threaten democracy. Russia's foreign ministry has also reacted to recent tensions in the U.S., saying the archaic U.S. electoral system, which does not meet democratic standards, and the politicization of the media were to blame for American divisions and the unrest in Washington. Moscow said the violence is largely the result of social gaps observed in the U.S. The U.S. president has reportedly spoken to aides about pardoning himself in his final days in office. U.S. media said that Trump has raised the issue in several conversations with his advisors since the November vote. The outgoing president has been asking if he should take the action and what the legal and political consequences would be for him. Trump potentially faces federal charges concerning his efforts to obstruct a probe into alleged ties between his 2016 campaign and Russia. Legal experts are divided over whether a president can lawfully issue a self-pardon. No president has even tried it before, but Trump has already granted more pardons and commutations to his allies more than any of his predecessors. Damascus has called on the UN to put a stop to Israeli atrocities, stating the regime's aggressions pose a threat to regional stability. Earlier, we discussed this issue in detail with our guests in our news review program. Here it is. Syria calls on the United Nations Security Council to take decisive and swift measures to prevent repetition of Israeli attacks. In a letter to the UN, the Syrian Foreign Ministry added regime's flagrant violations of UNSC resolutions that Security Council pose a threat to the stability of the region. Damascus stressed Israel's acts of state terrorism and its synchronization with terrorist organizations prove full coordination between the regime and the Daesh terror group. Statement comes following Israel's Wednesday's raid on Syria. The regime has itself confirmed over 50 acts of aggression against Syria in 2020. Recent upsurge in the number of Israeli attacks is seen as a reaction to the Syrian forces' success in battling foreign-backed terror groups seeking to topple the government of President Bashar al-Assad. And now joining us for this program is Muhammad Ali, joining us from Damascus, and Paul Rudy from the Syria Solidarity Movement, joining us from Berkeley, California. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. Hope you're both safe and doing well, and Happy New Year to both of you. Muhammad, I guess we'll start there with you in Damascus. Give us the latest if you can, bud.
Yes, Syria's foreign ministry sent two letters to the United Nations Secretary General and Security Council, informing them on the latest Israeli attack that happened on southern Syria. The foreign ministry said that the attack is in violation of the UN Security Council Resolution 350 related to the disengagement of forces between Syria and Israel, because the Israeli attack that happened 24 hours ago was launched from the occupied Syrian Golan. And the foreign ministry asserted that Israel continues to practice state terrorism, pointing out that the Israeli attack coincided with the terrorist attack by terrorist groups on a bus killing Syrian citizens in Syria's desert in central Syria. The foreign ministry went on to say that undoubtedly, and I quote, this proves the full coordination between Israel and those terrorist groups, and that their mutual goal is to prolong the crisis in Syria and hinder the Syrian army from achieving full victory against the remaining terrorist groups inside Syria. Now, the letter also asserted that Israel's continuous implementation of its aggressive policy also proves there is full coordination between the three occupiers, as the letter described them, the three occupiers of Syrian soil, which are Israel, Turkey, and the United States. And finally, the letter concluded the foreign ministry by renewing its call on the United Nations Security Council to shoulder its responsibilities under the UN Charter in preserving international peace and security, and taking decisive and direct measures to ensure such terrorist Israeli attacks are not repeated.
Thank you, Mohammed. And Paul, I'd like to welcome you to the program as well. Now, Paul, how does this work, or how does it not work? How does Tel Aviv get away with, you know, carrying out any unwarranted and illegal, you know, nighttime raids or daytime raids, or basically fighter jet raids on Syrian soil with no UN mandate, with no permission from anyone, and he seems to get away with it? How is this happening?
Israel is breaking international law. I'm shocked. Shocked at them. But they've been doing that for a long time, and so has the United States, and so has Turkey as well, as Mohammed pointed out. And all of Syria's enemies have been working working with and using terrorists. That's ISIS or Al-Qaeda or Hayat Tahrir al-Sham and so forth. I know it's they do this because it's expedient to do so. You know, Israel has been sheltering terrorists inside territory that it controls in the Syrian Golan Heights, for example, and it evacuated I think it was close to at least 400, maybe as many as 700 terrorists from southern Syria when the Syrian army expelled them. And Israel is accustomed to working with terrorists, which seems appropriate because they're basically terrorists themselves.
And Paul, how does it work that the UN Security Council hasn't really moved on this very issue? This is not the first time. I'm going to get back to Mohammed in a second to talk about how often Damascus has asked for help. I mean, it's called the UN Security Council. Where's the security? I mean, you have multiple occupation forces on Syrian soil. You have a neighbor that's bombing you whenever it wants to. So what's the point of having a Security Council if it does not respond to these multiple requests out of Damascus to have its sovereignty respected and have security restored on its soil after 9 years?
The only way that Syria Syrian sovereignty is going to be respected in the Security Council is when Syria gets a permanent seat with veto power on the Security Council, which is not going to happen very soon. The Security Council cannot function without the United States or any of the five permanent members, and they will veto any actions that condemn Israel or that cause sanctions against Israel of any kind. It's the United Nations is toothless. It's not going to do anything. I was going to say, unfortunately, Syria is basically on its own. Syria, with its allies, is on its own. The United States doesn't pay any attention to condemnations against the United States. Why would Israel? And so it really, it's up to Syria and its allies and to defend themselves. They need to work together.
Gentlemen, stay safe and have a great year, both of you. Thank you for joining us on the program. Mohammed Ali there joining us from Damascus, and Paul Arudi joining us out of Berkeley, California. That's a wrap for this segment of News Review. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now. The Atomic Energy Organization of Iran says that the country is capable of enriching uranium with a purity of up to 90%.
The progress made means that we can easily enrich uranium up to 40, 60, or even 90%. Of course, the text of the Parliament's Strategic Action to Lift Sanctions law stipulates that the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran is required to enrich uranium above 20% if need be. We have the capacity and the capability to do that today.
Behruz Kamavandi was referring to a recently enacted law which is aimed at forcing signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal, or the JCPOA, into compliance with the accord. The law requires that the government reduce commitments unless nations' interests enshrined in the agreement are safeguarded. In line with the legislation, Iran stepped up uranium enrichment on Monday from less than 4% to 20% purity. Tehran says the measures are reversible if other parties to the nuclear deal meet their share of commitments. In 2018, the U.S. president unilaterally withdrew his country from the JCPOA, throwing the deal into chaos. Iran's probing the assassination of top nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was assassinated over a month ago in Tehran. At the same time, families of slain Iranian nuclear scientists have taken steps to sue the U.S. as a main supporter of the chain assassinations, which have now targeted 5 Iranian scientists, as Yusuf Jalali reports.
Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, a name that defined Iran's nuclear energy program. The top Iranian nuclear scientist was assassinated in November last year. In terms of who was behind the incident, Iran has from the outset pointed the finger at Israel. Israel has a track record of killing Iranian nuclear scientists since 2010. Fakhrizadeh is the 5th to be targeted. While Iran has revealed that it has tracked down some of those involved in the attack, families of the slain nuclear scientists have separately initiated a lawsuit at Iran's Court for International Affairs, not against Israel, but against the United States for, quote, systemic support for Israel's terrorist activities against Iran. The lead lawyer of the lawsuit says if the case is certified, Iran can freeze American assets in some countries and transfer them as compensation to the families of the victims.
The families of the slain scientists demand that the masterminds of the attacks be punished. Iran does not recognize Israel as a country, so we file a lawsuit against the U.S. as the major supporter of Israel's crimes. The case will be reviewed at Iran's Court for International Affairs, and then we will take further legal proceedings at an international scale. This is to relieve part of the pain inflicted on the families of the victims.
Iran says the assassination of its scientists pursues a single goal, to deal a heavy blow to the country's nuclear program. But the emotional side effects are even heavier to bear for the families of the victims. Like 14-year-old Armita, who lost her father when she was only 4. She says she will never forgive those who took away her dream. Israel has not commented on any of the assassinations of the Iranian scientists. But as to the last one, it has already spilled the beans on itself. Fakhrizadeh had long been on Israel's hit list. This remark by the Israeli Prime Minister perhaps says it all.
This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
But this time around, Iran was quick to respond. Days ago, the country resumed enriching uranium to 20% purity, surpassing the 3.67% cap set by the 2015 nuclear deal.
While Tehran interprets the elimination of its nuclear scientists as nothing but an attempt to derail its nuclear program, The hunt for those culpable in Fakhri's Zadeh assassination is placing the remaining pieces of the puzzle, which observers say is giving stronger clues of an Israeli link to the issue. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bloomberg's year-end report on the wealth of the world's billionaires shows that the richest 500 people on the planet added $1.8 trillion to their combined wealth in 2020, accumulating a total net worth of $7.6 trillion. Surging billionaire wealth hits a painful nerve for the millions of people who have lost loved ones and experienced declines in their health, wealth, and livelihoods, says Julia Conley Ryder in an article published under the heading, Amid Warnings of Surging Worldwide Poverty, Planet's 500 Richest People Added $1.8 trillion to combined wealth in 2020. Please stay tuned for the details of this article. Bloomberg's year-end report on the wealth of the world's billionaires shows that the richest 500 people on the planet added $1.8 trillion to their combined wealth in 2020, accumulating a total net worth of $7.6 trillion. The Bloomberg Billionaires Index recorded its largest annual gain in the list history last year, with a 31% increase in the wealth of the richest people. The historic hoarding of wealth came as the world confronted the coronavirus pandemic and its corresponding economic crisis, while the United Nations last month warned is a tipping point set to send more than 207 million additional people into extreme poverty in the next decade, bringing the number of people living in extreme poverty to 1 billion by 2030. Even in the richest country in the world, the United States, the rapidly widening gap between the richest and poorest people grew especially stark in 2020. As Dan Price, an entrepreneur and advocate of fair wages, tweeted, the 500 richest people in the world amassed as much wealth in 2020 as the poorest 165 million Americans have earned in their entire lives. 9 of the top 10 richest people in the world live in the United States and own more than $1.5 trillion. Meanwhile, with more than half of the U.S. adults living in households that lost income due to the pandemic, nearly 26 million Americans reported having insufficient food and other groceries in November, contributing to a rise in shoplifting of essential goods, including diapers and baby formula. About 12 million renters were expected to owe nearly $6,000 in back rent after the new year. Tesla CEO Elon Musk enjoyed a historic growth in wealth last year, becoming the second richest person in the world and knocking Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates down to third place. Musk's total net worth grew by $142 billion in 2020 to $170 billion, the fastest creation of personal wealth in history, according to Bloomberg. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos is at the top of the list with a net worth of $190 billion. Bezos added more than $75 billion to his wealth in 2020 as the public grew dependent on online shopping due to COVID-19 restrictions and concern for public health. While Bezos and a select few others in the U.S. have amassed historic gains in personal wealth in the last year, the federal government has yet to extend much in the way of meaningful assistance to struggling Americans. The Republican-led Senate recently continued to stonewall a vote on legislation that would send $2,000 checks to many American households. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell denounced the proposal as socialism for rich people, even though the plan includes a phase-out structure and individuals making only up to $115,000 per year, not those in the highest tax brackets, would receive checks. Surging billionaire wealth hits a painful nerve for the millions of people who have lost loved ones and experienced declines in their health, wealth, and livelihoods. Chuck Collins, director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies, told Bloomberg recently, "Worse, it undermines any sense that Americans are in this together. The solidarity required to weather the difficult moments ahead," he said.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billahi al-aliyyil azim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wa sallallahu ala sayyidina wa nabiyyina abil qasim al-mustafa Muhammad. وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين أجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف وجعلنا من أعوانه وأنصاره. Last night we talked about a very important dimension of balance that must exist in every person and in our community, and that is the balance that we should strike between being emotional and being rational. We need to have both, and if we lose one of them or if we overdo one of them, then it creates problem. I mentioned two hadith about the significance of having a kind of emotional unity or connection or link with Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And now I'm going to share with you the third hadith, which leads us to another characteristic of the community, and that is truthfulness. Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam, in a famous hadith, said, "Inna Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala atla'a ila al-ardi fakhtarana wa khtara lana shi'atan." Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala looked at the earth, looked at the people, and among them he chose us, and he chose for us some Shia, some followers. Yansurunana, these are the people that help us, these are the people that work for achieving our goals. Then Amir al-Mu'minin said, من أضاع سرنا أضاقه الله بأس الحديد. If someone discloses our secrets, Allah will make him taste the pain of iron. It means that he is going to see the attacks of the enemies, the swords and bombs and killings coming from enemies, prison, torture, because he was not careful about keeping the secrets. Okay, now because Amir al-Mu'minin mentioned the point about truthfulness, I move to the other characteristic of the community of Ahlul Bayt, which I promised in the first night that inshallah we are going to expand on that. The community of Ahlul Bayt has to be truthful. Hadith says, even with respect to your children, you have to keep your promise. If you say, I'm going to buy a bicycle for you, you have to buy. If you say, I'm going to take you this weekend, you know, to park, you have to take. Don't say, you know, he will forget. Allah will not forget, even if that child forgets. Hadith says, أَحِبُّ السَّبِيَانِ وَارْحَمُوهُمْ وَإِذَا وَعَدْتُمُوهُمْ فَفُوا لَحُمْ. Love children, be kind to them, and when you promise them, you have to keep. That poor child cannot take you to the court, but Allah is there to defend the right of this child. If you promise your wife to do something, to buy something, to take her to her mother's house, you have to keep your promise. And of course, if ladies, you know, give promise to their husband also, they should keep. So, everyone should be honest and trustworthy. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala enable us to equip ourselves and our community with these important and fundamental qualities, inshallah.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here, who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Tonight we remember one of the great personalities among the companions of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and that is Habib ibn Madahir al-Asadi. But we must know that he was not only a companion of Imam Hussein, he was indeed a very great companion of Amirul Mu'mineen and Imam Hassan alayhi salam. And it is said that he had also met Rasulullah, but his life was not enabling him to be a companion or to be with Rasulullah for a long time. But he had the honor of seeing Rasulullah. But he was very close to Amirul Mu'mineen alayhi salam. And according to some sources, he took part in all the battles that took place in the time of Amirul Mu'mineen. In Jamal, in Safin, in Nahrawan, he took part in all the battles. And he was one of Shurtatul Khamis. I don't know if you have heard Shurtatul Khamis. There were few people who were totally dedicated to safeguard, protect Amirul Mu'mineen and implement his commands. He was one of them. And also he was a hafiz of Quran, a memorizer of the Quran. You know, all these companions of Imam Hussein, they were very special. Sometimes we think that they became special just because they managed to be in that day with Imam Hussein alayhi salam and get the great, you know, foes and happiness of Shahada. No. They were in the first place special so that they were given tawfiq to be with Imam. There were many other people who didn't have that tawfiq. There was some honesty in them, some truthfulness in them, that Allah gave them that tawfiq, that they gave their life in that crucial time and till end of the world. Everyone who remembers Hussein remembers them. Everyone who sends salam to Hussein sends salam to them. As-salamu alayka ya Aba Abdullah wa ala al-arwah allati hallat. Billions of salam are going to be offered to Imam Hussein and to them. So it is great tawfiq. So he was a very special man. He was a hafiz of Quran, and it is said that he was reciting the Quran, entire Quran, in the night. After Salatul Isha, he was reciting. Because, you know, those who are hafiz, they love to recite Quran, and also they need to keep reciting so that they don't forget. Even Imam Hussein alayhi salam, after his martyrdom, he mentioned, as we will explain. He was one of the people who wrote to Imam Hussein alayhi salam when he heard that Imam Hussein has refused to pay allegiance to Yazid. He was one of the people who mobilized other people, other Shia, and, you know, said we should invite Imam and we should help Imam. And when Muslim ibn Aqil entered Kufa, he was with Muslim. He helped Muslim. According to some books, he and Muslim ibn Awsaja, they were, you know, very close. So they were asking people to give bay'ah to Imam Hussein. So the people of Kufa, they were paying bay'ah to Imam Hussein alayhi salam by these two people asking them. But unfortunately, when Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad entered Kufa and, you know, started threatening people, and people left alone Muslim ibn Aqil, those people also who paid allegiance, you know, unfortunately withdrew. Then the tribes of Muslim ibn Awsajah and Habib ibn Muzahir asked them to go with them and try to hide them so that they would not be killed, because they were remained, you know, without any helper. When Imam Hussein alayhi salam entered Karbala, then Habib and Muslim ibn Awsajah, they took the opportunity to go and join Imam Hussein alayhi salam in Karbala, but they were only traveling during the night. During the day they were hiding themselves, and finally they managed to reach Imam Hussein.
That was The Characters of Shia Community by Hujjatul Islam, Dr. Shomali, and the program The Spiritual Message of Islam.
I'm looking back throughout the years to breathe is hard, and my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
Oh Allah, please send your salutations to Muhammad and all Muhammad. Oh Allah, please forgive us. Please forgive all our sins and mistakes and shortcomings. Please enable us to serve you with full honesty and truthfulness and sincerity. Please include us among the best followers of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad. Please protect and safeguard our community and our families and our youths from everything that you don't like. Oh Allah, please hasten the reappearance of Imam Zaman Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. Please make our Imam Zaman happy with what we do and what we say. Please answer his du'as for his faraj. Please give shifa to all people who are ill. Please give shifa to people who are ill in their body and in their soul. Oh Allah, please send your rahmah, your forgiveness to all who have passed away, especially brothers and sisters who were attending these majalis in this community and other communities. Our parents, our foreparents, our teachers, our ulama, our maraji, those who have passed away. Please let them be with Muhammad and Ali Muhammad right now. And please give long life and blessed life to the parents and to the teachers and maraji who are alive. Oh Allah, please make the last moment of our life the best moment of our life. Wa akhiru da'wana and alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
My ummah, he will say, Rasulullah on that day, even though we've strayed from him and his way. My brothers, my sisters in Islam, let's struggle, work and pray. If we are to bring back the glory of his way. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alameen, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alameen, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
in the limelight.
When detainees at an Alabama jail got sick or simply asked to be tested, they were put in solitary confinement, says Clarissa Donnelly D. Roven, writer, in an article published under the heading, Immigrants Detained by ICE Say They Were Punished for Requesting COVID-19 Tests. Here's the details of this article. ETOWA, which contracts with the federal government to hold people detained by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, stated in court documents that it was taking precautions recommended by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, including quarantining new arrivals, implementing social distancing measures, and providing cleaning supplies. But Golding and more than a dozen other ICE detainees say the measures taken were inadequate and led to a massive COVID-19 outbreak. Seven of the men say they were given only one disposable mask every 3 weeks. One shared a photo of what he said were the only cleaning supplies he'd received. A toothbrush, toothpaste, comb, and combination shampoo body wash, which came inside a gift bag from the Salvation Army emblazoned with the words Merry Christmas. Immigrants inside ETOWA also said that many new arrivals were quarantined for 5 or 8 days rather than the recommended 2-week period, potentially allowing the virus to spread. According to a partial ETOWA roster obtained by The Intercept, and in these times, ICE transferred at least 24 people into the facility in June. By the second half of July, the agency reported that 21 detainees, nearly a quarter of those housed in ETOWA's ICE unit, were sick. When Golding came out of his cell and saw the condition of those around him, the organizer part of his brain clicked back. I'm looking at people that's literally looking play in the face, he said. And medical is doing nothing for them. Golding decided to tell everyone in the unit to request a test for COVID-19. So you have Africans, you have Jamaicans, you have El Salvadorans, you have different groups, Golding explained. What I did was say, hey, listen, you talk to your people, you tell them this. Many people were apprehensive about asking for a test, as guards had already put the few who were presumed positive into solitary confinement, a fate the United Nations says amounts to torture. In solitary, detainees said they were locked in cells without air conditioning for around 23 hours a day. The average high temperature in July in Gadsden is 91 degrees. Nevertheless, by July 4th, everyone in the unit, more than 80 people, had put in requests to be tested, according to interviews with Golding and another detainee, as well as the affidavits of 9 detainees included in a petition for a writ of habeas Golding filed on his own behalf in the Northern District of Alabama in September. 2 days later, according to the 11 detainees, ETOWA County Sheriff's Officer Captain Mike O'Brien called the lockdown of the unit and read out the names of 10 detainees who'd been especially vocal in calling for mass testing, including Golding. O'Brien told them to pack their bags because they were being sent to solitary confinement. At the time of their transfer, none had tested positive for COVID-19. All 11 sources said they felt this was punishment and retaliation for requesting the coronavirus test. I noticed that all of us who were randomly picked were the ones who were vocal, outspoken, and shown desire to be tested, Stanley Walden wrote in a complaint dated on August 7th. He handpicked cells and made an example in front of everyone that he really meant to throw anyone who get tested into a dungeon. Sebastian Abalokana wrote in a complaint dated on July 28. "It feels like punishment for standing up for our right to health and safety," he said. After locking down the unit, the captain and other staff members went cell to cell asking the remaining detainees if they still wanted to be tested for COVID-19, according to Golding and the affidavits of nine others. Most detainees revoked their request and agreed to sign waivers saying they no longer wanted to be tested. In a recorded conversation involving two Itowa employees obtained by The Intercept and in These Times, one employee described the events of the July 6th as an attempt to bully people into not getting tested. Afterwards, both employees said in the recording, "Immigrants inside Itowa appear too scared to seek even basic medical care." Four of those who were sent to solitary confinement said they were unable to communicate with their families for days, leading some concerned family members to call the facility. The relatives of one detainee said jail staff assured them that their family member was fine at the time he was in solitary confinement, having developed symptoms of COVID-19. Golding's mother said she was told there was no evidence of the virus at the facility, even as ICE listed at least one coronavirus case at Itowa on its website. According to the family members interviewed for this story, neither ICE nor Itowa ever reached out to tell them their loved ones were sick. The Itowa County Sheriff's Office did not respond to detailed questions from The Intercept and in These Times about the jail's COVID-19 precautions, the detainees' allegations of retaliation, and whether detainees had authorized the release of their medical information to family members. "The health, safety, and welfare of those in our care remain a top priority and concern for the agency," a spokesperson for ICE wrote in an emailed statement. "Since the outbreak of COVID-19, ICE has taken extensive steps to safeguard all detainees, staff, and contractors, including reducing the number of detainees in custody by placing individuals on alternatives to detention programs, suspending social visitation, incorporating social distancing practices with staggered meals and recreation times, and through the use of cohorting and medical isolation." ICE's public guidance on how detention centers should respond to the pandemic says facilities must ensure that medical isolation is operationally distinct from administrative or disciplinary segregation or any punitive form of housing. Yet, as a previous investigation by The Intercept found, a number of ICE facilities have failed to adhere to this requirement. According to detainees at Itowa, solitary confinement was used not only as leverage to discourage requests for testing, but also to isolate people with COVID-19. The Intercept and in These Times spoke with five men who tested positive for COVID-19 while detained at Itowa. Each said he spent weeks in solitary confinement. Shamoe Edwards developed COVID-19 symptoms just days before Golding. At first, he planned to quietly sweat out the illness, but with a history of bronchitis and a recent diagnosis of sickle cell trait, he got too scared to ride it out on his own. He hobbled over to an officer and told him he felt like he'd been hit by a truck. Not long afterwards, Edwards said he was transferred to solitary confinement. The men universally described the conditions in solitary confinement as squalid. In their affidavits, many expressed distress that they no longer had access to mental health professionals, the law library, sunlight, or fresh air. "Civil detention have turned into torture," Fele Koroma said. Bakadir Majidov, who was deported in September, wrote that there were cockroaches and flies in the unit. Golding wrote that he was fed uncooked frozen food and didn't have access to drinking water because the sink in his cell didn't flow properly. One detainee said he spent 21 days in isolation. Another counted 35 days and a third counted 54. Golding said he was in solitary confinement from July 6 until August 28. Edouard said he was put in isolation on June 29th and wasn't released until July 28. "We were getting the same treatments as when you get in trouble," Edouard said in an interview. "Even though it's properly a different word, it's isolation. It's still a form of punishment, a form of torture that they are putting us in." Edouard received the results from his coronavirus test on July 8. He was positive. One day later, Golding received the same bad news. In isolation, the men say their phone access was limited. They could only make calls during a brief daily free period, no more than 75 minutes, which occurred on an irregular schedule. Sometimes they said it might be in the middle of the night. Before he got sick, Edwards would speak with his mother and brother a few times each week. After not hearing from him during the 5 week of July, his brother, Nico Edwards, who is a police officer in Flint, Michigan, called Etowah. The first person he spoke to transferred him to someone else. "That person answered and told me that they looked in the computer and they told me Shemoy is okay. He's on the floor and nothing is wrong with him." Nikoy believed the facility at first. Then a few weeks later, his brother finally called, telling Nikoy he was in solitary confinement and had the coronavirus. The U.S. criminal justice system and the immigration system are deeply entangled, with harsh consequences for black immigrants in particular. One out of every five people facing deportation because of a criminal conviction is black. As of July, about half of the people detained by ICE at Etowah were black, including Golding, Edwards, and many of the other men interviewed for this story. Several are lawful permanent residents who lost their green cards and became deportable after criminal convictions. Rather than accept deportation, many immigrants remain at Etowah for years as they fight their cases, often because they have nothing to go back to. Golding and Edwards were both born in Jamaica and came to the United States of America as children. Edwards, now 30, arrived at 15 on a green card. Most of his family now lives in the United States. Golding, now 36, arrived at age 9 to reunite with his mother, who had fled an abusive relationship. He has never been back to Jamaica. Before being incarcerated by ICE, Golding served a 10-year sentence in federal prison. He and his family say they didn't know there would be immigration consequences for his criminal conviction and that he was served his time.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.